Accession number 10165, reel number 53.
Martin McLean, reel 53. You were telling me how this time when you were employed at the prisoner of war camp at Newtown St. Boswell was the first time that you were recorded, you worked under rank, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. I didn't feel this change of appointment because I was just the man in charge of a prisoner of war camp. In there was about 160 German prisoners of war. Of all different branches of the service, some of them very supercilious and some used to scowl at you. And I had an English speaker and a Lagerführer. A Lagerführer was like a sergeant major in charge of the Germans, liaison between me and him, and the German speaker used to do the interpreting. I had, every job I went on, I had funny incidents. Well, with these lads, they hadn't been Tretlake soldiers. Well, I had a great respect for Germans. Don't ask me why. I was comparing them with Japanese. When we fought them, I had respect for them. They'd pick up the wounded, let's put it that way. They'd look after or they'd take prisoners. Unlike the Japs, they'd kill everything that was in their way. I decided they were too slovenly and too slack in their method of approach. No one knew who was going to work. And we had working with us a man called Mr. Franklin, who was an ex-RSM of the Highland Light Infantry. His job now was the man who was responsible for prisoners of war, who's civilian, by the way, working with the government on land hire, hiring out the Germans to the farms for farm work. We all got on well together, but the whole camp was slovenly, and I thought the barrack rooms were untidy as well. Far too bad for anyone that was a trained soldier, my opinion. So I started smarting the Germans up. I got some floodlights put up, and I used to make them form up every morning, and every night a roll call would be held, just the same as they did ours. And unless I got a true count of them, I'd keep them there in the rain or snow, or no matter what it was bad weather at the time, and until I got the count correct.
What year was this then?
This would be about the end of, about 1948, I'd say, roughly speaking. Years to me, them days, is just moving from one job to another. And I treat these men, and they start respect me for the way I was making them look like soldiers. We had arms and rifles, but they had no weapons, obviously. I used to parade my staff with them, by the way, to ensure that it was a proper staff parade. And then the lorries would turn up and take them off to work. On one incident, the man who provided the lorries sent up some flat wagons for to take the prisoners off. And I was pelting down of rain. I'd done my roll call. Granted, they had their top coats on and raincoats, whatever they had, but they wanted to travel quite. And I'll tell you where the garage was of the person who provided the lorries from Earlston, near St. Boswell's. And he didn't have. The rule was he had to send covered wagons to take the lads off to do farming. And when I saw the lorries, two of these lorries were just flat lorries, no cover on at all. I tell the drivers to take them away, and they start arguing the fact that they've been sent to take prisoners out. I said, don't care what you do. I said, the prisoners are not travelling in lorries like this in this weather. Off you go, and I chucked them away. Well, again, the Germans are unknown to me. I've got a great lot of respect for them. I chased them off the billets. The covered wagons were filled and sent off, but the ones who had the flats, I said, no, off they went. They had a number of military vehicles that were using for this job of ferrying prisoners off the farms as well. One night I was in the camp, and I had a habit of going around the camp just patrolling as I would, and nothing else to do really, to see what was happening. And there was nobody in the huts, and there was always somebody in the hut, always somebody making something, woodwork or clarting on. You'd see the ball in the huts, but I just went in to see what was happening, to see that there was everything was all right. Get it this way. The prisoner of war camp didn't have any barbed wire around it. We were in an open camp. The prisoners could go out for a walk if they want, down the road. They weren't allowed to frat or anything, but they could go out walking. But this was strange to find no one there. So I went round, down one side of the huts, and back up across the road and up another way. And I saw a man saw me coming along, a German soldier saw me coming along, and he ran away. And the way he ran immediately gave me the impression something was on. So I ran up after him, and I had a huge barrack room, which had been like a bathroom and had been made into bathrooms, but it was a warmer type of bathroom, a barrack room, and a larger one. And you could see the way they set out, there was a court martial going on. Now, this was amazing to me. They could see a man stand up there, and he was white faced, ashen. And there was these people sitting at tables in front, like just like a court martial, and the audience sitting down the bottom. So I said, "What's going on here?" And I got a hold of the Lagerfuhrer, and he shut up. He wouldn't tell us anything, nor would the speaker. And so I took the man that was on the dock, apparently, took him away, put him in with the British troops for that night. And I phoned up OHQ and told them about the situation. And they came down and had a good look around. They had their own German speaker and interpreters up there. They didn't arrive at any conclusion. And so they went, sent for some civilian boffins who were the specialists in Germans and linguists as well. And they started ferreting out what had happened. They'd been actually holding a court-martial on this man for something he'd done during the war. And then, before I arrived at the camp, they'd found a German soldier hung on the trees, and they couldn't understand the reason for him, just that the man had committed suicide, as we used to have in the regular army pre-war. Now and again, a man hung himself. But then they attributed this hanging not so much as a voluntary thing by the man, but by the court-martial that's been going on. Along came another big crowd of people, very specialist in German things, and I had to cancel all work in the camp this day and form up all the men on the parade ground, which I'd had made, I told you about, with the lighting on, and stand them knees, let them stand around, but nobody dispersed. I had my men ensure they dispersed. And they took them through the cookhouse, and they took one man at a time through the cookhouse and spoke them and what have you. And there they found, they finished up with about 15 SS men. Now, I didn't know this. They've got a tattoo under here. And they all profaned the
under
one...
Under the armpit?
No, just about here.
Upper arm.
They don't profess to be SS men when they're taken prisoner. But they found these 15 people, and they were carted away that day. And they were the troublemakers. From there on, the camp became quite settled. Short while after this...
Did you have an officer with you?
No.
And how many men were
in
your command?
Let's put it this way. There was 13 such camps, and we had a commanding officer at the headquarters in Kelso and an adjutant, and also a second-in-command, and different officers, and an RSM in charge. And they never used to come to the camp, just on an occasional inspection. I run it, I'd done everything, I was in charge, maintenance and feeding and everything.
How many men did you have?
About 130, 106. My own soldiers, we had about 4 soldiers, 5 with me.
So 5 soldiers and 130
prisoners. Myself, another sergeant of very doubtful character, and 3 men. A short while after this, I was sent for and asked, they'd been keeping their eye on us apparently, so this is what they told me. They'd like me to take on the job of regimental quartermaster sergeant major, which was a promotion from sergeant major. It was a same WO2 job, but it's an appointment to RQMS in charge of all the camps. I went up to the headquarters in Kelso and took over this job. And my job was then to go around the 13 hostels in the border country to cater for them, to see that they got their food, to see that they got their... Actually, the civilians just supply food, but see that everything was going right in the way of food, clothing, bedding, clothing exchanges, socks, and all things appertaining to the quartermaster's branch. I love this job.
Were the prisoners being repatriated during this period?
Not this time, no. No, they're still static. This was a great job because every day I'd done my book work and I'd go off in a lorry or a big one or a little one with stores and travel around the lovely countryside in the border country, and it was spring at it now. It was beautiful. Hike, Kelso, Stubbs Camp, that was way up past Hike. Melrose, Roxburghshire. They had a number of camps in Roxburghshire, the ICI. And I used to enjoy going around the countryside. And I shouldn't maybe say this, but I got friendly with some territorial people in Gala Shields, and they lent me a rifle, 2.2 rifle. And the country was bounding with country, with their wildlife, pheasants and hares and rabbits. And my poor family back in Newcastle weren't getting fed. They were still on the ration. But from there on, I made sure they got the rabbits and the pheasants and the things. Whether I was doing wrong or not, I couldn't care. I was just doing what everyone else was doing. I fed my family from there on. The Archimedes' job was quite a canny little number. But then repatriation come up, and the Germans start being sent home. We had a quartermaster who was very hard on the Germans. He'd been a prisoner of war with them, Captain Lewis. He was very hard on them indeed. He was a Royal Artilleryman. Well, these lads used to save up their little bit pittance, their little bit savings of money, and buy coffee and stuff to take home with them. He'd confiscate that, which I thought was wrong. And the prisoners that I let through, I used to let them through with their coffee and things that I knew they'd bought themselves. But any unnecessary items of clothing that get taken off them. But the goods I knew they bought, I let them away with it. In consequence of this, the quartermaster and I had a terrific row. And the camp was falling up in any case. I was returned to my unit. So I hadn't been there a year on the job. So down I came again to Sergeant Major. So I went back to the 4th Holland Battalion once again at Bedlington. Whilst I was up there, we had a second-in-command. Whilst I was up at Kelso, we had a second-in-command. I forget his name for the moment. And he come to me one day, he says, "You're an infant man, you're well-versed with explosives and gunpowder and all that sort of stuff." I said, "Yes, sir." "Major Reed," they called him. He'd been in charge of the Home Guard in Kelso. He's a well-known character up there. I said, "Yes, I do, sir." He said, "Right, tomorrow morning, I'm getting some prisoners and yourself. You're coming with me to do a special job." He never told us what the job was, so off I set with these Germans with picks and shovels and me. I was taking off my duties, as I mentioned. And we went into the Duke of Buccleuch's estate, which was just down past the Springwell camp where we were. And as we approached these huge, massive gates, they automatically opened, which was amazing to me, you know. The end of the war, economies and everything, yeah, they had these big, magnificent, beautiful black and gold plated doors. They swung open as we approached them, and they closed when we went past. We motored past the Duke of Buccleuch's big palace. As a matter of fact, it was on the television just this week, or last week, and this girl who goes chasing around the helicopter, she was in the same castle where we passed. At the Duke of Buccleuch's in Kelso. And they took me right round the house into the forest, the jungle. Well, the forest, fir trees. Well, I'm a man that was well used with jungle and war and camouflage. And we could see if a track was used, if a path was used. We could see breaks of trees and what have you, where people had passed. It was something that you adopted automatically when you were in Burma. You could see that somebody had been there before you. Where they took us, no one had been there. And the major said, "Take this lamp, Sergeant Major. There's a tree there. It was just an old tree. Go and stand at the foot of there." And what I tell you is absolutely true. People won't believe it, but there has been... It's been spoken about quite a lot recently in papers and what have you, through interviews with me. I went and stood on this spot where he said, and slowly I started sinking down on the ground. The little plot where I stood just sank down like an oblong hatch. And I had my torch, and I switched on. He says, "You'll go down the bottom of the when it stops, get off, and it'll return automatic." And I went in this space. There's a huge nesting hut buried under the ground where we had been standing. There was beds in it. There you could see rifles stacked in the corner in it. There was grenades. There was all sorts of ammunition, and explosives. And I had a good look at this thing, and there were sticks of gelignite as well, and slabs of gun cotton with igniters. The whole caboodle was there for sabotage, for some team. I got talking to the major later on, and he told me that were a special type of commando, special service, who in the event of invasion by the British, by the Germans, would go underground and cause sabotage throughout the German, wherever they were. And appeared a similar description of what I saw on this occasion. The shelter under the ground was explained more or less exactly as I was it in the News of the World. They had a full diagram in the centre pages, exactly the same. They're talking about the special service people, and I was involved with one of them. And the local papers got on and they asked me to give my version of it. Coming back on the shelter, when I start making the Germans break into it, they had to break in through the top, clear the earth off. They were amazed. A complete shelter underground with beds, with rifles, with weapons, with grenades. They were astounded at the whole thing. Now our job was to clear everything out of there and dismantle and destroy this shelter. 2 years ago, I went back to see if I could find this tree where this lift was, which wasn't dismantled. But there's a bit of a holiday camp there, like now, caravans and things. So I never looked much further, just in the gate, and so it was all caravans now, in the same part of the estate. The Germans were amazed at it, and I took the gelignite out. I knew a lot about it, but I didn't know everything about it. And we put it in a dustbin, and I put it in a lorry with sandbags around it. And I drove with the lorry. I drove the lorry back myself, back to the camp where I was, and put it at Springwell Camp in the middle of a big ploughed field. We put it down the ground and put all this gelignite in the dustbin down below and covered it for waterproofing and sent for the specialists to come and have a look at it. Well, when the specialists saw it, they went crazy. It shouldn't have been shifted. The gelignite was wet, as they call it. And at least that friction would have exploded. I didn't know, so Martin was lucky on that case, got the stuff back, and they blew it up where it was, in that camp at Springwell. As I said, the camp was falling up, so Martin was on the move once again. The quartermaster and I fell out, and I was posted back to my own camp. I was sent back to Brandspeth camp this time, because the 4th Holden Battalion, it also had been disbanded. And Brandspeth was still our camp, but they'd done away with the main camp. Brandspeth Castle was the headquarters of people dealing with all the likes of me, you know, the odd cases scattered around through the country, dealing with them as servicemen. I was there just a short while, and then I was posted to a job in Blandford Camp, another Sawanko posting, surplus warrant officers and sergeants. And I was told that I had to go and help out at an army school of cookery at Blandford Forum in Dorset. Down I went, and I met the lieutenant quartermaster, just a young man, just been promoted, and I met the Major Pierce, and he welcomed me to place. He says, "I'm sorry that there's no position for a Sergeant Major as such." He says, "What we must do with you is that you'll assist in the quartermaster stores. The CQMS has been with us for a long time, and due to go on leave, he can't get away until someone takes over from him." So I said, fair enough. I'd been RQMS and UQ stores, maybe that's why they sent me, and I was quite willing to take over. But there's no official handover as such took place. I used to stand in the stores and watch what was going on, handing of clothing over to the storeman and everything. Well, to do things properly, a man must hand in a cook's apron, get a one back. Well, these cooks had the hat, the shirt, the white jacket, the blue and checkered trousers, and an apron. And they were just saying, coming into the store, "I'll bring me other stuff back, just give us my set of laundry, my set of change." And this storeman was giving them it. And I said, "That's not right," to the storeman. I said, "You're bound to be down if these lads are getting away with this. You'll be down in your stores, man." And he sort of shrugged his shoulders. Well, he couldn't care less. The CQMS was due to go on leave, and I was waiting to take over from him, you know, a proper handover, which is two stores supposed to do. The next thing I heard that he says, "I'm off now." He says, "It's all yours." I said, "Hey, hold on here." I said, "This doesn't do me." I said, "I've had no handover." So went before the quartermaster, and the quartermaster, being a new man, didn't know what to do, so went before the CO. I said, "I don't take over no store, sir, because it hasn't been handed over to us. And I'm not going to be responsible, as I know happens. When I go back to my unit, you'll say, 'Oh, he was to blame, he was to blame.' There's no fear you doing that with me." I said, "Either I take the stores over officially, sign for them, account for them, count everything, or I just take it on trust, on your word, that I'm not held responsible for it." The CEO didn't know what to say. He says, "Well, the CQMS has promised to go on holiday." He says, "Right, what's wrong with you? You let him go, you take over, and see what he can do." Whilst he was away for a fortnight or 3 weeks, I forget which it was, the lad was overworked, I'm going to say that as a CQMS. He should have had more help at his job than he had himself and a storeman. And after all, he had a load of cookery classes and cook's classes where young national servicemen were being taught to be cooks. That those who were in the big kitchens, little kitchens, bakery sections, cake sections, and they had an awful lot of stores on their charge. Apart from all of the 300 or maybe 200 national servicemen, their cook's clothing, their bedding and their equipment, he was responsible for it all. Whilst he was away, I started carrying out a check of the cook's clothing, the thing that caught my eyes, first of all. And the number of deficiencies in there was fantastic. So then I carried out a check of all the stores. And then I went on to a check of all the barrack room stores like brushes, sweeping, brushes hand, brushes scrubbing, brushes hard, and all the different things that they have in the barrack rooms. And then I noticed the barrack rooms are in a very dilapidated condition. And anyway, I found there was a terrific number of deficiencies just in the stores that were on issue, like G1098 stores and barrack stores alone. And I went and told the quartermaster. He went berserk. A young man just took on the job. I didn't know he'd just taken on the job. And then we went and saw the quartermaster, the colonel, the major again, Major Pierce. And I explained what I'd found. I said, I've gone into every venue trying to find out what has happened to the stores. No chance of finding it at all, because I've been through everything that I know as an infantryman where things could be or hidden or forgotten or laid up, and there's nothing there at all. These are deficiencies. And I'd rang up barrack stores, the barrack accounts, and got the price of these things. And there was a 400-odd-pound deficiency of stores. That was just cook's clothing and the stuff that was normal for the harbour men. I said, well, have you got a contingency allowance whereby you have barrack charges taken off the men, which was normal in peacetime, whereby each man had company stoppages, battalion stoppages, and an amount of that money was put aside for losses and damages within the barrack room that you were serving in, like breakage of windows, all paid off. If they didn't catch the culprit, he was made to pay for a broken glass or the loss of the thing. Didn't pay once, he paid for two, by the way, in our army's funny ways of working things. But if it wasn't found, then this money was there to put the thing right, you know, keep the barrack in order, to hand over to the next unit coming in. I said, there's more than that, sir. They were then white and shaking. I said, the barrack room's in a fearful state. I said, no, you are responsible for the barrack rooms. I said, when this unit marched into here, he says, well, what's marched in? This is a major, but he's a cook major, you see, Army Catering Corps. I said, marching in is when a unit comes in to take over the camp. They take over the barrack rooms, and they're taken through with the barrack clerk of works, and he hands over your barrack room with lights in, with ablutions in working order, and window panes all in working order, windows in working order, and you take over the whole encampment like that. That's what you call marching in. Now, your barrack rooms are in terrific state, sir. Broken toilets, broken this, missing basin plugs. And I said, if you wish, I'll carry out a check of there. So I carried out a check. Believe me, when I went to see the clerk works and start pricing how much windows were and the stuff that had been issued or given to this unit, it was another £400 bill. 470-odd, I think. Now, this was a sad thing for him, because within a certain amount of money, you can get a local court inquiry and get a write-off. But for an amount of money like this, it was a War Office court inquiry. And so it was deemed that it was to be a War Office court inquiry. Now, to do a 100% check to ensure that they had everything that I'd said was missing was missing, they sent also someone from Aldershot to work with us. Everyone's leave was stopped for that weekend. They were all rushing off to London, different places, and I didn't make very many friends through that, and that was including the RSM, who was a cook man. Everything had to be brought out of the kitchens on the square. Every little item of equipment, like camp kettles, buckets, knives, forks, spoons, mixing bowls, the whole lot, had to be brought on. And would call out mixing bowls, pudding, 10. There was many more, say 30. The 30 things had to be brought out and put before the CO. Buckets, 1 gallon, iron galvanized. All had to be brought up and shown. And then they were taken back to the cuckoos. And it was proved that I was correct in my tabulation of maybe an odd one or two items that had shown up. He asked me how they could get out of this, because it's marvellous how the other parts of the corps, all higher paid than the infantry, lacked, which I've mentioned many a time, which is one of my bones of contention, all being higher paid than me. For instance, a sergeant major in the Caton Corps received nearly twice as much pay as me. They hadn't a clue on these things that are important for the welfare and the looking after the troops. What they done then, they had me in to see what could happen. I said, I don't know what transpired here, sir, before. I said, but I understand that a quartermaster, sir, you didn't have a takeover here. You didn't take the stores and things over when you came here. He says, no, I didn't. And I said, I understand that the quartermaster before you was a bit of a mad egg on a motorbike, and he got killed on his motorbike. That was the case. It turned out right. I said, well, sir, the only thing I can tell you two who are just new to this unit is to just say that you took the unit over in that state. They've only been in the job about a month or 2 months, I don't know. And plead that this was the state of the unit when you took it over. And there was no handover, so therefore the onus is not yours. This they did, and they got away with it. They got a complete write-up, a complete repair of the camp, and a complete renewal of kits. Now, consequence of this was the chief captain advisor came down from Aldershot to meet me specially. And I was introduced to him, and he got on talking with the CO, cups of tea and what have you, in the office. He says, I've come to ask you a very private thing, he says, which I want you to give great consideration to. He says, I want you to transfer to the Army Catering Corps and work with us in the sort of line that you're doing now. And he says, in no time you'll be a lieutenant quartermaster and rise up, as the case may be. In fact, I saw the army being run down instead of being built up. But I missed an opportunity of a life there. I should have gone to the SEC. I was still a Durham Light Infantry man at heart. I wanted to be with my regiment, but I should realise once we were at Borden that Durham Light Infantry was finished as such. There was no such of going back the old ways, the old methods. And I always regretted not taking that. So I refused him, and I asked for a return to my own unit, because I'd made so many enemies in the camp, which was part of my job, which if I'd been doing, if I hadn't been there now, a spare man again, the CQMS was back, I was now a spare man, then it was no good to me. I wanted either a job or something, a static nature. I was sent off to do a check of another camp, which had deficiencies, but that's neither here nor there. It was just part of the job they were putting us in. Then I asked for a return to my unit. I got returned to my unit, back to Fenham Barracks once, not to Fenham Barracks, to Brandsmith once again. I hadn't been there very long. I don't know whether the order room staff were looking after me. I knew the man called Lancaster, who'd been with the Holden Battalion. I don't know who was at the order room then, because I didn't stay at Brandsmith any length of time. Once they knew you were available for a job, you just used to go home and just wait to be sent for. And I was delighted to be home, trying to put the house right and decorating and all that sort of stuff. Sent for one day and told us a job for us. I didn't stay any length of time at battalions or anywhere. Others used to stay for ages, you know. They seemed to be stuck there. I was told I had to go to Salisbury, Southern Command, report there to Southeast Asia Command, I forget the name of the officers at the moment of these, but I went down to this, and I had to report to the officer who was in charge of all personnel in the camp. He was a lieutenant colonel, but he's in charge of all the odd bods in the camp, so that all the strain of the work was taken off the div commander and the area commander and everything. And he was responsible for many things, and he had an adjutant working with him. And they got me in, they told me that they wanted me to take over a mobile recruiting exhibition, which at that time was down in Falmouth. The person who was running the thing wasn't satisfactory, wasn't doing the job satisfactory. And would I go down to Falmouth and take over from him? Well, I didn't even know what they're talking about. So I asked the adjutant when the CEO had left me. The CEO gave me all sorts of instructions, what I had to do, how I had to run the thing, how I had to be in contact with them about things that went wrong or alterations in there.